It is my great pleasure to welcome back after a prolonged absence Susanna De Vries, award-winning author, historian and biographer. On this occasion, we're going to talk about 10 mistresses of the royal family of the House of Hanover and Windsor. We begin with King George I and I guess finish with Camilla Parker Bowles. Susanna is well known nationally and internationally as the author of a series of books about Australian women, so this is something of a departure for her. And Susan joins me now in our Brisbane studio. Susanna, your timing is impeccable.
Thank you.
I mean, you couldn't bring this story out at a more apt moment in modern history.
Oh, well, I've been working on it for many years, actually, Philip. Yes, I suppose it is an interesting time.
How did you get embroiled in the mistresses?
Well, I was married for 16 years to a psychiatrist who came here to be a professor at the University of Queensland, and he'd been consulted by several members of the royal family because he worked for the president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And Princess Margaret actually mentioned quite a lot of things about dear Uncle David, who was the Duke of Windsor. And my father had been at Dartmouth Naval College with the Duke of Windsor when he was Prince Edward, and he got the fatal attack of mumps, which made him impotent, but of course has been all hidden. It's not the great romantic love story that we were led to think. I mean, he's a very sad character.
We actually dealt with him in some detail a week or so ago, because we've also been a bit lubricious at this time. But what I'd prefer to do now, having established your motives, let's look at the first mistress of the British branch of the German House of Hanover, because this is extraordinary. An avaricious woman of low morals who would have sold the king's honour for a shilling. Well, tell us how she got the rights to actually mint currency.
Well, through George I, who was rather mean, and he didn't actually want to support her. Royal mistresses are meant to wear jewels and beautiful clothes, and he'd actually divorced his wife and left her in Germany, something that's also been kept carefully hidden for a long time, and he was anointed head of the Anglican Church, which didn't believe in divorce, and they conveniently forgot he had the wife. And Melusine was annoyed that she hadn't got an income. Like Madame de Pompadour, she got a sort of state income to dress beautifully and all the rest of it, and she didn't. And she worked out a sort of cash for access scheme to George I, and a bit similar to Fergie.
But hang on, did he not give her a pile of Irish titles?
Well, he gave her the titles because land came with them, and then she could rent the land out for money, and so that would pay for her carriage and her clothes and her beautiful embroidered gowns, and she got the right to actually print some coins. But the Irish Dean Swift took exception to this and wrote pamphlets about her. She was going on a trip to Ireland, but she thought they were going to riot against her, so she decided not to go there. She must be really the most evil of all the royal mistresses.
Tell me, do any of those coins survive? They'd be worth a fortune.
They would be. I don't know. I've never sighted any, I must say. It'd be very interesting. But she sold them off. She sold off the rights to the coinage very hastily when they threatened to take action against her. She sold them off to a manufacturer of Birmingham saucepans, which I thought was rather nice.
I must say, when I think of the mistress of the king being allowed to, you know, to mint coins, it gives heads and tails
a new
significance, really.
Absolutely. This cash for access schemes go on. Several of the mistresses did this in order to enrich themselves.
Well, there's a precursor, of course, to the idea of private interviews, which has been a recent embarrassment with Fergie, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think she sort of looked... She did read history quite a lot. She wrote some things about Queen Victoria, and I think she must have read about this and thought it was a good idea. But then, you see, you get the poor unfortunate ones, like Perdita was junked off with no money at all by the future Prince Regent. Some of, Melusine, it's hard, you wouldn't feel sorry for Melusine, but Perdita I really felt very sorry for. She was thrown out in the streets when he got tired of her with a small child, and she'd given up a career as an actress. She let down the Shakespearean company that she had offered her leading roles and said, no, the prince needs me, etc., and thought he was really in love with her, and he wasn't. And then he behaved equally badly to Maria Fitzherbert.
Eleanor on RN, and I'm talking to author, historian, biographer Susanna de Vries about the royal mistresses of the House of Hanover-Windsor. George II's wife chose his first mistress for him, didn't he? Or didn't she? Last night we were talking to a couple of royal biographers, one of whom made the point that the current queen is more than happy to invite a woman who was perhaps uncomfortably close to the Duke of Edinburgh to official occasions. But let's leave that aside. George II's wife chooses the mistress.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, it was very sad. She loved her husband, but she'd got terrible gynecological problems after having 10 children, and so she really thought that she could control it. If the mistress worked for her, she was a woman of the bedchamber and had to serve her meals on bended knee, she thought she could control this relationship. There's a lot of very interesting psychological situations in all this, and these terrible dysfunctional childhoods of the Princes of Wales.
The future king was allowed to visit this officially sanctioned mistress in her room, but only for an hour a night.
That's right, and then he went to have dinner with his family. I mean, there's some riotously funny things in all these stories.
But she found him rather boring, apparently, and
he was a very boring
man. Not very good in the cot.
No, and he kept talking about reforms to the army and army uniforms.
Oh, that's a turn off. That's a turn off.
All interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So, what became of her? Was she tossed out of the palace? And
no, she'd got him to sign. She'd actually got a signed agreement that when he broke off the relationship, she would get money. And so to buy a house or build a house, and she did actually build herself a rather beautiful house at Richmond, which is still open to the public today. And so she did quite well, and then she had a horrible drunken husband who died, and then she married. She actually made a genuine love match. There's very few genuine love matches in all this. Everybody seems to be making arranged marriages and then having mistresses afterwards.
Well, I think that continued even to a large extent with Charles and Di, but putting that aside.
Oh, absolutely.
We've discussed the sad absence of these specially minted coins, but I understand there's also a collection of ringlets and pubic hair. I wonder if that survives in the Royal Archives, and can you tell us about it?
That was the Prince Regent, who was the future George IV, and he seemed obsessed. He had a fetish about hair, and he collected a ringlet and some pubic hair from all his mistresses and all the courtesans and prostitutes he slept with. And he
must have had
collection.
Enough to stuff a mattress.
Well, that's what his brother, the future William IV, said when these were found. And they were found by a valet when George IV died, and he called in the Duke of Wellington, who was the Prime Minister. And it was all very hush-hush. I mean, they certainly didn't want it to get in the papers. And the Duke of Wellington ordered this grisly little collection to be burned.
Oh, how sad.
So it's not in the Royal Archives.
Imagine if it went under the hammer at Sotheby's.
Make a fortune.
Well, the Queen Victoria's knickers reached a very good price about 10 years ago.
Yes.
But a collection of pubic hair and ringlets.
Well, it would be absolutely stellar auction, wouldn't it? Probably better than the jewels of the Duchess of Windsor.
Absolutely. Now, the future George IV had persuaded a beautiful Shakespearean actress, this is Perdita Robinson, to abandon the stage, become his mistress. She does all right, does she not?
Well, no, she doesn't. She has a bond whereby he's going to buy her a house when he's 21, because he's only 18. But she gives up her theatrical career for him, and he turns her out into the street without a penny, and she tries to blackmail the prince's father, George the Third. And she doesn't actually get all the money that's owed her. They fob her off. Nobody really does very well blackmailing the royal family.
These days, of course, with what used to be Fleet Street, I think they do very well, would they not?
Well, I don't know. certainly Daisy Warwick, who thought that she could sell the love letters of Edward the Seventh back to the royal family to stop. She said, I'd like money for not publishing them in my memoirs. She found that George the Fifth, who was the son of Edward the Seventh, put lawyers onto her and said, under the Copyright Act, the letters are mine. And it was just war was the First World War was just about to be declared, and he said, this is an act of really sedition against the royal family, and demanded that they were handed over, or she could have been tried for treachery. And so she handed them over. But the irony was, she was very wealthy at one time, but she'd spent so much entertaining Edward the Seventh and on Warwick Castle that she lost all her money.
LNL on RN, and I'm talking to author, historian, biographer Susanna De Vries about the royal mistresses of recent times. I like the idea of being paid not to write. In fact, my pension scheme involves getting people to bribe me not to write my autobiography. And, you know, the things one could say if one was of a mind to do so. Now, let's sort of work this out. George the Fourth had ended up having to marry someone royal and who had an extensive dowry because, of course, he was had vast gambling debts. I mean, is it true it's 30 million in today's money?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? But it was an era of really high gambling.
Was he a sort of a whale, as Kerry Packer would be described?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. He just couldn't stop. He had two passions. One was for gambling and the other was for buying art. And in fact, the royal family have done rather well out of his passion for art because, aided by Maria Fitzherbert, he had a very good eye for art and he bought some of the best paintings in the royal collection.
So a good eye for art, but a bad eye for horses and cars.
That's right, yes. And he was deep in debt. There was a line of debt collectors in the street outside Carlton House, his palace, on which he'd also spent a great deal of money furnishing it. And he spent a great deal of money on the Brighton Pavilion. He just had no idea about finance at all.
He was more than pleasantly plump, wasn't he? Didn't he have to be hoisted onto his horse?
I'm not so certain about that. It was actually Edward the Seventh who had a contraption in order.
I'm mixing up my plump, yes, plump royals.
A contraption in order that he could make love to his mistresses at the end of his life.
Okay. Now, I was thinking someone who was hoisted onto a horse.
I think that was Henry the
Fifth. Hoisted onto his mistress. I didn't know about that. Wow.
More interesting, actually.
Okay, let's. After George the Fourth dies childless, his brother Bill the Fourth, comes to the throne. He had a long-term mistress.
Poor Dora Jordan, who'd borne him 10 illegitimate children, and she's junked off without a penny. So
ten,
he can marry ten. The princess.
Wow. And did the kids live with him?
Yes, yeah, they all stayed with him. And she went off and died in France.
You turn off the mic and have a little coughing fit, and I'll cover for you for a second. We're discussing royal mistresses, and I'm absolutely shocked at the behaviour of these heads of state, because, you know, one doesn't expect it. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. So he's got the long-time mistress. What happens to her?
Oh, well, poor Dora Jordan has to go to France. Sorry, I think I've got a frag in my throat. And she dies there with no money at all.
I think the royal family have poisoned you. I think...
No, they were accused of poisoning Princess Caroline, actually, who was the poor wife of George the Fourth, who got locked out of Westminster Abbey.
Okay, let me. We're running out of time and we've got so many mistresses to deal with. His brother, Prince Edward, Duke of Kent, Queen Victoria's father, had been sharing an apartment with his mistress for over 20 years. That's a very loyal relationship.
Yes, it was a very loving relationship, but there was no heir. He was expected to marry a German princess and produce the heir. And so poor Julie de Saint-Laurent was again told to leave. And Queen Victoria, when she came to the throne, was so shocked to find out that her father, or her deceased father, had had a mistress, that she ordered all the documents to be burned by members of the royal household, and Julie's portrait. And I found one portrait of her, but she really is the lost mistress.
During the course of your researches, you discovered that a lot of shredding went on. Again and again, it became an urgent matter to burn a lot of documents.
That's right, yes. I mean, historians tend to think, it'll all be there in the documents. But it's quite disturbing to find out how many documents have actually disappeared or are still locked up in the Royal Archives, including the replies to Edward VII of Lady Jenny Churchill. And there's a beautiful portrait of Lady Jenny Churchill in the book. And the mother of the person who let me put the portrait in, because he's a descendant, his mother asked if she could see the letters in the Royal Archives, and she was the niece of Jenny Churchill, and they wouldn't let her see them.
Now, Susanna,
this is bad.
We're running out of time, and there's so many mistresses. If fornication was an Olympic event, say at the forthcoming London Olympics, Edward VII would in fact be up, would be a sure thing for gold.
Oh, he'd get gold. He would absolutely get gold.
He was a sex addict. Tell us about his addiction.
Well, it's quite sad, actually, because sex addiction, psychiatrists often say, stems from the fact that the man has been ignored by his mother, which was very much the case. Queen Victoria didn't really like him. She's favourite son was Prince Leopold. And she thought he was responsible for the death of Prince Albert, who discovered that he had a mistress, as Edward had a mistress who was an actress. And she never really forgave him after that. And I think he felt this, and I think he wanted to be seen with lots of beautiful women. He used to enjoy parading them around at the races and things. And he also was, used to go to brothels in France a tremendous amount, including a brothel visited by Toulouse-Lautrec, where he was a very frequent visitor.
But this was quite reckless in the sense that we're talking of a time when syphilis was widespread.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a very important point, and he was really quite lucky. But he had this sort of dichotomy that he liked the prostitutes and courtesans, but he also liked society ladies. He liked Daisy Warwick and Lady Jenny Churchill and Camilla's great-grandmother, Alice Keppel, because they were socially acceptable. He could take them to dinner parties and they entertained him to dinner in their houses. And I think he was bored. He was very bored by Queen Alexandra.
But if you were an aristocratic lady in London, if you were in Debrett's, it was almost an honour, wasn't it, to get dragged into the royal bed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it started off with people like Melusine were in it for the money, and then it became a social thing. He was a very charming man, Edward VII, in fact. And people, did like him for him. His mistresses liked him for himself. They weren't in love with him, but they did like him. And they, took him, he was... They inquired great social kudos because he was seen in their houses. People loved, gave them lots of invitations because they were the royal mistress.
And the husband would sort of just, blur his eyes or gaze into the middle distance. Yeah,
absolutely. Or go out on shooting parties with Edward VII. When you look at those photographs, there's usually a complacent husband somewhere around.
One wonders whether there's not a lot of royal blood coursing through the veins in England that are not known or acknowledged.
Oh, I think there is. I really think there is, and some of them have come to Australia. It's quite interesting.
I've known a couple of royal mistresses that were Australian lasses. But I'm not going to divulge it on air. I'll tell you later on the QT. So, okay, we've got gambling princes, we've got sex addicts. I spoke to Anne Seber a couple of weeks ago about Wallace Simpson and Edward VIII, but you've got an interesting addition to her research. Tell us briefly, it has to be in a minute, about Nanny Green.
Well, he was... Edward was fixated on his nanny because Queen Mary never came near him in the nursery. Poor stammering Bertie, who we saw in the King's Speech, and Edward were just ignored. She never came near them. And the nanny was actually eventually put in a mental hospital. She'd lost her own child. And she would sort of cuddle him one moment and spank him the next and fondle him sexually. And he had a sort of passion for his nanny. And
You'll finish up in the tower. You'll finish up in the tower, young woman.
Well, I'm writing, lucky I live in Australia, aren't
writing this outrageous book. Susanna De Vries, Royal Mistresses of the House of Hanover Windsor, published by Purkiss Press. That's our lot for this week. Don't forget you can comment on this or any of our stories by going to abc.net.au/Radio National, where you'll also find a retrospective of my now 21 years presenting the program. It's called, unfortunately, In Bed with Philip, and you can tweet us at LNL on RN or me at Philip Adams ABC. Thanks, team. Mirta Tardias, Anne Arnold, Paul Gough, Chris Short, Mike Pritchard here in Muswellbrook, and my executive producer, Gail Basario. Thank you.